From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from a festively decorated and seasonally cold New York City, New York. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say thank you, thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. As more and more information keeps spewing at us through more and more forms of media, cumulatively seeming to result in us truly knowing less and less, on this show, I want to slow down and go more in depth when circumstances warrant. Such was the case with our extended visit with Leslea Newman, best-selling author of Heather Has Two Mommies and 70 other books a few weeks ago. We heard from some of you that you liked hearing a more comprehensive conversation than the usual three-guest format State of Belief follows. And as we had into the last weeks of 2018, we'll take the opportunity to really take the time with some high-profile guests to explore the big picture in their particular areas of expertise. Next week, expect another provocative and insightful conversation with Rachel Maddow, the host of MSNBC's popular The Rachel Maddow Show. We'll talk about the results of the midterm election, the latest developments in the scandals surrounding the administration, and the challenges of reporting complicated stories in an age of short attention spans and simplistic rhetoric. Later in the month, my friend Shelley Wright will be back with us for a holiday edition of our series, Whosoever You Love, affirming the dignity and love of LGBTQ persons within and beyond religion. Shelley's new Christmas album is titled Santa Will Find You, and we'll have the entire hour to talk about music, family, and the state of our nation through the eyes of one brave, creative, and patriotic American. I'm also looking forward to a comprehensive look at woman-led LGBTQ-affirming ministry in the 21st century with two groundbreaking faith leaders, the Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner of the Metropolitan Community Church and Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum of Congregation Beit Simchat Torah. That's going to be our year-end special program on State of Belief. Rest assured that come the new year, we'll be back to our headline-chasing ways. But I'm really excited at the prospect of slowing down, getting deeper, and sharing with you the wisdom and perspectives of some truly special individuals after sitting down with them for face-to-face, in-studio conversations. And we're actually starting this approach with this week's show. The interview you are about to hear has been months in the planning. Dr. Richard N. Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, a position he has held for over 15 years. Articulate in describing the complicated intersections between power, populations, and principles, and accomplished at analyzing what those interconnections lead to. Dr. Haas is a regular member of the Morning Joe panel on MSNBC, and he is the author of numerous essential books, the most recent being A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy, and the Crisis of the Old Order. Now, because this topic is so critically important, and my respect for Richard's insights so immense, we are dedicating this entire program to a conversation that I doubt will soothe, but I am certain will inform and educate. We're speaking on December 4th, 2018, at the Council on Foreign Relations Studios in New York City. Richard, thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me, and your comment that it's unlikely to soothe reminds me of what I once heard from the pulpit, that the job of the preacher is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted.
Well, I think it's safe to say that we're living in a time when nothing can be taken for granted anymore. So I don't want to assume that everybody listening is familiar with what the Council on Foreign Relations is and what it does. So could we start with just a brief explanation of that?
Sure, happy to. Council on Foreign Relations is nearing its 100th birthday. It was created in the aftermath of World War I. The hope was to provide to create an organization where you could have a regular, informed conversation about the relationship between the United States and the world. And over this century, we've evolved in several ways. We've now got a national membership of about 5,000 people. We published the leading magazine in the world, Foreign Affairs. We've got a large number of scholars who are writing about every part of the world or every issue you can think of. We hold more meetings than I can count. And increasingly, we're trying to be a resource, not simply for specialists in the field, but for people, for citizens, for students. We don't teach these issues very well in our schools, I'm sad to say, but as citizens, we need to be informed. We owe it to ourselves. We owe it to our families and our neighbors. So our goal is to help people get smarter about the world, about the foreign policy choices we have. Let me just make clear, we're not partisan. We're not Democrats. We're not Republicans. We're not associated with either party. We're also independent. We don't take any resources from the U.S. government or from other governments. The whole idea is we want to be able to speak truth to power and just be as honest as we can.
Yeah. Several times in one-on-one conversations, I have express to you my gratitude for you taking religion so seriously and providing multiple opportunities and resources for religious leaders from all segments of religion and offer trustworthy briefings related to foreign relations. I hear people say, what does the Council on Foreign Relations have to do with religion? Would you answer that?
Our connection with religion is not to promote faith, though I'd like to think I'm a person of faith. I remember President Eisenhower once said, I don't care what religion a man has so long as he's got one. We ourselves, though, don't have an institutional position on it. But look, there's any number of issues where I think there's an intersection with religious issues and values. Take questions of global hunger or physical safety around the world. If you have situations like in Syria where 500,000 innocent people have lost their lives, years ago in Africa and Rwanda, close to 1 million innocents lost their lives, or you have issues like the spread of nuclear weapons that could be a threat to human life, or take an issue that many young people care tremendously about, issues like climate change. You know, God created the heavens and the earth, and man seems to be going out of his way to shape those in ways that won't be good for our futures. So there's all sorts of issues that I believe involve human life that people need to hear about. So when they go in and go into their church or mosque or synagogue or what have you, they talk about those things and hear about those things. I say one other thing, what the United States does in the world, what we do and how we do it, Well, that can have an important religious component. Do we stand for religious freedom? Where people are persecuted around the world, is that something the Secretary of State, the President of the United States stands up for? Do we say to another country, look, we don't tell you how to run your business, but when you start persecuting or killing people on the basis of how they pray to God or whatever their religious practices are, that's something that we as Americans simply find unacceptable. So I think it's important.
But what was the motivation? What caused you to say...
Oh, you want me to confess?
Yeah. What caused you to say, I want this to be a part of our program?
Okay, here's where it came from. Of course, truth. You get truth from me. I was reading, and it was over 100 million Americans, well over, and we're a country of what, 325 million? So something like 100, 150 million Americans every week go to a house of worship, go to a church, go to a synagogue, go to a mosque, whatever. I said, that's a lot of sermons. Now, it's hopefully that maybe, what, 75% of the people are awake during the sermon? And I said, if I can somehow help the people who got to give the sermon, give them some background in these issues so they feel more comfortable addressing them, then I think this becomes then another place where we can educate and teach. And in the same way that we think of schools, we work a lot with journalists. There's any number of places in our lives, in our worlds, where we need to be exposed to good information, to serious thought, to reasonable analysis. And why can't that be something that happens in churches?
I'm speaking with Richard Haass, author of the book, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. As authoritarianism seems bent on creeping back into more and more halls of power, I can't help but see the parallels between blindly following religious doctrine and blindly following a despotic leader. Of course, I'm not talking about all religions, and I'm not talking about all believers, but do you see trends where vulnerabilities created by doctrinal obedience are exploited by political fealty?
I guess the way I would answer that is I have problems with absolutism in whatever form it takes and whatever motivates it. Whether it's done in the name of religion or in the name of politics or just about anything, that kind of intolerance leads to no good. It will ultimately cause a lot of destruction and a lot of harm. I think there's got to be a place for questioning. There's got to be a place for dissent. I understand orthodoxy. I understand what it means to be devout. But I still believe there's got to be a place for individual judgment, individual consideration. No text tells you everything you need to know. Many of these texts are hundreds or thousands of years old, and they've got to be adapted to modern circumstances in ways that were never anticipated. So I get nervous, I get uneasy when people claim to have unique insight into what was the truth or what was intended and how it implies to your life or mine. I think there's got to be some space, some room for debate and for individual choice. Now, implicit in that is not everyone's going to come out in the same place. Yeah. Could be consequences. And I think religious organizations and churches and what have you have to decide what their boundaries are. And at what point you say to someone, well, you can go do that, but then in a funny sort of way, well, not funny, then you've taken yourself outside. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that happens. I think any religion or any organization, for that matter, that has a degree of orthodoxy and rules has to decide to what extent it's prepared to bend them or even accept in their midst people who violate them either out of weakness or out of intent. But that to me is the conversation that's worth having.
Do you have any idea how to make people have that?
If I did that, I'd be in a different line of work.
You're right.
Foreign policy is tough enough. I know my limits.
Okay. All right. Scores of us, and I'm using us, have learned important insights from what you're doing here in this place. We understand more about foreign relations. We see the intensity of the importance of foreign relations, and we see the complexity that has to be dealt with every day. So I think you have helped us in the religious community immensely. I'm curious, what, if anything, have you learned about religion that impacts the way you look at foreign relations?
Well, I've changed in some ways. I come out of a tradition in the foreign policy, international relations world that's known as realism. And the core of realism is that we look at our interests in the world and we're pretty hard-headed about them. And we don't have too much of an emphasis on what you might call values or issues like religion. Mm-hmm. And what I've come around to is that without going to the other extreme and saying the only thing we should be worried about or we should necessarily always put values first, there's got to be a blend. There's got to be a mix. I think it's partially who we are as Americans. This is a country that's founded not on religion but on religious freedom. We're founded on an idea. This is a land of tremendous individual freedom and choice. And it's important, I believe, that our foreign policy to some extent reflect it, not that we impose that on others. But it's got to be a consideration. To me, one of the real challenges I wrestle with when it comes to thinking about U.S. foreign policy is that balance. To what extent do we promote hard interests as opposed to values? I mean, this is not abstract. Look at the debate we're having these days about Saudi Arabia. The United States has a number of hard security and economic interests with Saudi Arabia. It produces one out of every 10 barrels of oil in the world. It's strategically located. We're worried about Iran and so forth. On the other hand, I believe the evidence is about as clear as it ever gets in this business that the crown prince of that country gave the order for an innocent individual to be murdered, and murdered brutally. And so one of the questions then is, well, what's then a smart foreign policy? How do we balance our strategic and economic concerns, which are important, with this moral and ethical concern? Do we just conduct business as usual and say we don't have the luxury? Do we go to the other extreme and say, well, because of this murder, we're not going to have anything to do with this strategically important country? And if we're not prepared to embrace either extreme, how do we get it right? So this is – now, when I used to teach, I spent 4 years teaching at Harvard. I couldn't get in there as a student, but I was able to get on the faculty. And I used to tell my students, once I told them they were smarter than I was, and I wouldn't take it out on them when I graded their papers. But I used to say foreign policy is hard. And this is a perfect example about why it's hard to think about this kind of a trade-off or balance. And Saudi Arabia is just, you know, one example. Right now, China, you know, largest country in the world, world's second largest economy, arguably will be, along with us, one of the two most important countries of the 21st century. They are persecuting the Muslims in the western part of the country. The numbers I'm hearing, about a million young men in particular, are in quote-unquote re-education camps, which is a euphemism for what this is, against their will. And the challenge then, or the question that arises, is to what extent does that factor into our overall relationship with China? Because we have a range of economic and political and strategic interests. And how do you work that balance? So these, to me, these are real questions. These are not, again, something for academics to go worry about. And this is why I think it's important to have people who come from a religious background, who people of faith, to weigh in on these subjects.
Several years ago, I was asked to participate in a debate at Oxford University on whether or not American religion is destroying American values. Recently, President Trump has chosen to ignore both the findings of our intelligence experts and our nation's core moral values in responding to critical international issues. So what does the Council on Foreign Relations say about the importance of core moral values?
Just to be clear, the Council on Foreign Relations doesn't take institutional positions. Many of us work here, and we've got over 300 staff members. And as I said, we've got 5,000 members. There's a whole range of opinions. We don't vote and we don't say this is the party line and everybody has to adhere to it. So I disagree with a significant percentage of what is said and written here. I always say my role is quality control, not editorial control. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important. So there's a range of views about to what extent ought moral considerations, to what extent ought they to play a significant role when it comes to American foreign policy, and how does one weigh them as opposed to more traditional foreign policy interests. So take another example recently, Turkey arrested an American preacher I could tell they had no basis for doing so. And one of the questions that arose, what sort of sanctions should we put on? To what extent should we make that a bilateral relationship with a NATO ally? Not much of an ally, let me make clear, but an ally in name in any case. What extent should we make a contingent on their treatment of this religious leader from the United States? So these are real world problems, and the intersection of religious and considerations, values, morals, persecution issues, and good old fashioned foreign policy, national interest concerns, economic and strategic. I think it's something you can't escape from.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I also know when I listen to you and I listen to a lot of your staff, you haven't pushed morals away. Mm-hmm. You may not be saying here are the five things you've got to do to be okay with us. So how does morality impact what you think, how you work out issues?
I can speak for myself. By and large, my experience, governments that treat their own citizens with respect tend to treat their neighbors with more respect as well. If a country is intolerant at home and abusive at home, it's unlikely to be peaceful abroad. So I actually think there is something of a connection. So I take it seriously. And again, if we're gonna go to war for somebody, or we're gonna provide them assistance in one form or another, one of the factors in determining how supportive we ought to be, how generous we ought to be, has got to be whether we believe the people we're going to bat for share some of the same values and priorities about life that we do. It's very hard to go to an individual, or even though we've got an all-volunteer army, or to that person's family, and ask people to make sacrifices on behalf of a immoral or amoral regimes. It's asking an awful lot. And maybe an extremist, you have to do it. But by and large, I think it's one of the things we've got to take into account when we decide who we are. If we're going to put resources and above all human life at risk, I think we have the obligation to take these kinds of considerations. I worked for President Bush 41, who just recently passed away. I spent 4 years working with him at the White House, and it was the best experience I ever had, working for one of the most wonderful human beings I've ever had the good fortune to meet and then to work with, for in this case, for 4 years. And I remember in 1990, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, for him, one of the important factors, in addition to oil, in addition to the strategic importance of the Middle East, were the reports of what Iraq and what Saddam Hussein's troops were doing to Kuwaiti people. And he felt an urgency to do something because the reports we were getting were ghastly. But also there was an urgency to it. And a lot of people in the Congress were saying, there's no rush. Let's give sanctions more time. Let's give them years to work. And I remember the president in his frustration saying, if we don't move, there's not going to be a Kuwait left to save. Mm-hmm. And that became a consideration. People forget that foreign policy is it's made by people. Made by these human considerations, and going from what happened in 1990 to what happened a few weeks ago, I think one of the reasons there's been such a strong outcry about this murder of this journalist at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul is it's something that people can imagine. It's so gruesome, and it's also about one person. It's not some enormous statistic that overwhelms us. But I actually think it's less difficult for me, maybe for, I won't speak for you, for some of your listeners, to get their arms around something that's that concrete, an individual dying in a gruesome way, than it is to read about some far-off civil war where very hard to get a sense of what's the daily reality.
Yeah. What do you think is the role of religion in people looking at foreign affairs?
Interesting question. I think for some people it is a code. It gives them a moral compass. Mm-hmm. For others it's more literal, and they have particular concern for religious rights, and they would give them a great priority. But the role of religion can range for everything from how to use military force, and you get into some of the great Catholic teachings about just war theory.
Right.
And about proportionality, not targeting innocents. It gets into the whole question of both when you go to war, mm-hmm. and how you go to war. When I was at the White House again for President Bush the father, when we were trying to explain to the American people in 1990 and 91 why it was potentially necessary to go to war to liberate Kuwait, we fell back a lot on the religious writings, both to help us clarify our own thoughts, but then to explain our policy. I remember, who was it? The Vice President, Dan Quayle, gave an important speech, very much based upon just war theory at the time. So I think there's that. But other times it's much more, again, literal to deal with the question of a persecuted people or a persecuted individual. And I think in some cases, it's interpretive. I mean, I mentioned at the beginning of our time, climate change. Mm-hmm. And if you see yourself on this earth as, how would I put it, being a custodian, and there's those who come before us, but in some ways, in terms of our responsibilities, there's those who will also come after us, and we have a particular responsibility to steward for them. And in running an institution, I always say my bottom line is I have got to hand this institution off in better shape than I found it. That's my obligation. And whoever comes after me has to, I believe, make the same commitment and hopefully perform at that level. But I think we collectively have that with the earth, and we're not meeting that. We are not meeting that obligation. We are going to hand over the earth and the air and the water and the climate in much worse shape to those who come after us than what we inherited. We are not being good stewards or custodians. Well, that to me is a real issue that I don't believe gets the debate it should. We, all of us want our children and grandchildren to be better off. Why then are we not focusing in on one set of policies that will affect their ability to be better off? Because right now, in some ways, they're going to be worse off. And that to me is a worthy conversation that is not taking place nearly as much as it needs to.
Your most recent book is enlightening and thought-provoking, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. Richard, is the world today any more in disarray than the world was before our time?
The short answer is, yes, even though, thank God, there's not a single great conflict like there was with World War I or World War II, and we're not living on the precipice as, say, we were during the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 60s, but the world is in greater disarray. There's more power. There's more capacity to do harm in more forms, in more hands than at any other time in human history. Whether it's medium states, large states, terrorist groups, there's these new technologies that we haven't figured out how to manage, from cyber to biological type issues. There's climate change I talked about before. We've got a lack of consensus in the world as to what the rules ought to be. We've got a United States that over the last 10 years has become quite reluctant to play the sort of role it's played for most of the, seven decades since World War II. So, you know, we're not in I didn't call the book A World in Anarchy or A World in Crisis. We're not there. Or A World in Chaos. I didn't call it that because we're not there. Right. But if you look at the trends, you look at the arrows, there's virtually nothing out there that's reassuring. So what worries me is things are going to get worse unless we act in certain ways to change what I believe is the trajectory. So I wrote this book in part as a wake-up call. You know, when you run for president, you can choose just about anything you want. You know, you can choose who you run with, you can choose your policies, what have you. The only thing you can't choose is your inbox, what's going to await you when you step into that Oval Office. And so when I wrote this book, I didn't know who was going to be the president. I didn't know if it would be Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, or somebody else, the man on the moon. But the one thing I did have a pretty good idea of what was going to greet them, what was going to await them. And I was worried about it because I thought it was about as tough an inheritance for various reasons as any president seen in quite some time. And what worries me now even more is 2 years have gone by and it's not getting better. It's getting worse. And at this rate, whoever is the 46th president, whenever he or she takes office, is going to inherit a world of even greater disarray. And that can't make anybody feel comfortable.
Is our world in disarray as a result of a multiplicity of consequences, or is it in disarray as a result of someone's objective?
It's a great question. We may want to switch jobs one time. The short answer is both. More the former, the sense that of things we've done or haven't done have had a real impact. But also there are objectives. Not everybody agrees with the rules of the world. Not everybody agrees with the distribution of power. Not everybody agrees with where borders are drawn. Not everybody agrees with how societies are organized. So you see radical terrorist groups that have, by definition, radical agendas and are willing to kill. You have a Russia that increasingly is willing to use force to change the map of Europe. You have a China that wants very different economic rules in the world. So I could go around and hopscotch around the world. So there isn't consensus. There are a large number of actors out there who have very different designs and have a lot of capability now, which is worrying. And the United States is more hesitant about what it's prepared to do, more divided about what it wants to do. So you add all this up, and you add it to things like some of the stuff we've either done, like, say, the 2003 Iraq War, which I believe history will be very critical of. And some of the things we didn't do when the United States stood by when Syria, say, was using chemical weapons against its people after we warned them not to. So you add up what I call acts of commission and omission.
Yes.
On our part, things we've done and things we haven't done. And then you add up these changes in the world, what people like me boringly call structural changes. And it adds up to a world that is, how would I put it, losing altitude when it comes to being organized.
My guest is Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. What are the hot spots right now? What's going on in the world, and where is it that you really worry about?
My short list of hot spots for conflict, I believe, could either break out or escalate. One is several places in the Middle East, above all involving Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Israel possibly growing out of Yemen, which is probably the worst crisis in the world going on right now, but possibly some other way. That'd be one. I worry about closer to home, Venezuela, where probably, 50,000 people a month are leaving that country. This is increasingly becoming one of the worst situations in the world. I worry about places like Pakistan. Pakistan is the world's fastest growing nuclear arsenal, has tremendous amount of terrorists. I worry about what it's doing to make the situation in Afghanistan worse. I worry about the potential for a conflict between a nuclear Pakistan and a nuclear armed India. Obviously worry about what Mr. Putin might do. He's already doing it in places like Ukraine. How do we know he won't do something like what he's doing in Ukraine to a NATO country where we have obligations? I worry about North Korea. The negotiations have failed miserably to get North Korea to reduce, much less give up its nuclear weapons and its ballistic missiles. So, I know I'm a pessimistic guy. It's what I do for a living here. But there's no shortage of trouble spots out there that I fear one day, when we wake up, that we'll see these dangerous situations have gotten worse.
Yeah. You travel the world. You know what the people all around the world are talking about. How does the international community see the United States right now? How have other countries and governments responded to President's resistance and his insistence on American first?
With very few exceptions, they reacted negatively. This is not the United States they thought they knew. The United States, since World War II, really beginning with World War II, has been extraordinarily generous. And it wasn't America first. It was the world first, but not as an act of philanthropy, but because we recognized our own self-interest was caught up in the state of the world. And the extent to the world was an economic partner, was not at war, where democracy was flourishing. This is a world in which we could be safer and freer and more prosperous ourselves. This president has a very different approach. So for a lot of the world, this is just the United States that is carrying out a foreign policy that is different in big, important ways. I also think, with few exceptions, they look at what's going on in this country. We're more divided. They look at our drug problems with the opioids. They look at our violence. They look at some of the challenges that the president's issuing to the courts or to the to journalists. And again, the model of American democracy, the quality of our society, is not what it is not something now that many others want to emulate. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite tragic. Now, there are exceptions. Some countries happen to like some of the specific foreign policy choices. For example, the government of Israel, Saudi Arabia, some other governments in the Middle East like the tougher line towards Iran, or they like the fact that we're not preaching to them about human rights or democracy. But most governments, either particularly the democratic governments in Europe, have real problems with what we're doing. They don't like the fact that we're getting out of many of our international obligations. Our allies are unnerved by the fact that we've become less predictable and less reliable. Even some of the countries that are quasi-adversaries, like China, find it extremely hard to deal with us simply because we're so unpredictable and very hard to come together diplomatically. So I think by and large, when you look at the numbers and the polls support this, that America's standing in the world has taken a significant hit. Now, I'll quickly say the purpose of American foreign policy is not to win Miss Popularity. We want to be respected. But I also think respect for us is down and a willingness to work with us is down. And we need partners. We can't do it all by ourselves. And we can't ignore what goes on in the world and be well off. So all things being equal, I don't think, and I'm sorry if this sounds partisan, but let me just make clear to your listeners, I've worked for Democrats and I've worked for Republicans. So it's not only that I run a nonpartisan institution, I've worked on both sides. And I've worked for both Presidents Bush and President Reagan. So I've supported Republican presidents quite a lot. But I do believe that historians will be extremely critical of American foreign policy thus far under this administration.
You're right about the way you do this. I've had the privilege of disagreeing with you as well as agreeing with you, and as I'm saying today. there was an event, one of the sessions that I was in here. I remember a Buddhist priest asking you how the Council on Foreign Relations strategizes for making peace. How would you answer that question?
Well, if, however we're doing it, we're not doing it very well. the results are in. And we as a council don't take a collective approach. I would simply say that, you know, individuals, whether they're who work here and write here or who are writing in the magazine Foreign Affairs or who are speaking at one of our many meetings, would argue their own path. And some, you know, some would have insights into maintaining a balance of power. You never want a country to be tempted into using force to think they could get away with it. Others would emphasize diplomacy and trying to resolve disputes. Others would emphasize trying to deal with what they think are, quote unquote, the root causes of instability in some countries, human issues, economic issues. Some would talk about the need for new global arrangements. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach about what you do for peace. Look, I've negotiated for the United States in any number of settings, Northern Ireland, Cyprus, the Middle East, India, Pakistan. And you can't have a formula. It's got to be adjusted. And all I would simply say is you never want anyone to believe that they can get more out of using force than using other tools. Mm-hmm. And you've got to persuade them that it's in their own self-interest to act with restraint and to accept compromise, which means you've got to discourage them from turning over the table. But you've also got to lead them to believe there's something in it if they act with a degree of reason.
Richard, I am really grateful for your work in foreign relations and your sensitivity about the importance of religious people understanding foreign relations. From where each of us lives in the United States, and regardless of the nature of our work and beliefs, what can a person, what can an individual do to strengthen the integrity of our democracy and make us a better citizen in this world?
It's the ultimate question for people who live in a democracy, so thanks for raising it. And I think this applies to religious people or people who are not particularly religious. We're all citizens, and our own fates are inextricably intertwined with the fate of this country of ours. Any number of ways we can make a difference. You can decide on a career choice. You could volunteer for the military. You could join the intelligence services. You could become a foreign service officer. You could go run for political office. You could work for someone who's running for political office. There's what's so great about this country are the multiple chances of or opportunities for entry. Even if you decide not to do any of those things, voting is pretty basic. Yeah. And I'm always distressed by how many Americans don't exercise this basic right and privilege. You can hold people who are elected to account. You know, we have what we call a representative democracy, not a direct democracy. It's the people who we vote into office who have to make decisions on our behalf. Well, we ought to let them know what we think. And if they act in ways that we believe are contrary to this country's self-interest, then we can vote them out of office. We can give our time. We can put up posters to support those we believe in. We can give money, if we have it, to people we believe in. We can go overseas and volunteer for this or that NGO, non-governmental organization. You know, churches have so many fantastic programs around the world, humanitarian programs. You can make a difference at a lot of levels. You can take the kind of course I have, where I spend my life working on foreign policy. But I know people who have gone and worked in villages around the world or cities around the country or in classrooms. Teachers make enormous differences. Individual ministers and priests and rabbis and others by the messages they send. I just think there's so many different ways to make a difference. And that, as long as people commit to making a difference, and hopefully it's a positive difference, then almost the details of it don't matter. But there's so many entry points where you can make a positive difference in this country and around the world. And you could do it at 36,000 feet working on policy, or you can do it at sea level, working in a classroom or in a hospital or in an orphanage or everywhere in between. The main thing is just to get involved, and it helps also to get informed. So, because if by being informed, the reason I do what I do, I want people to get more informed, and that will hopefully help them figure out how to get involved and what it is they want to support and so forth. So, you know, you asked at the beginning, what do we do? That's hopefully what we do here at the Council on Foreign Relations. It's what I try to do, is help people get better informed so they can either make better choices, and once they make that choice, they can make a bigger difference in whatever it is they determine to do.
Dr. Richard N. Haass has led the Council on Foreign Relations in the role of president for 16 years, an insightful voice on MSNBC's Morning Joe program. Dr. Haass is the articulate author of numerous books, the most recent of which is titled A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy, and The Crisis of the Old Order. Richard, I am immensely grateful to you for giving us so much of your time. I can't think of a more urgent issue to get a better understanding of than what we've been talking about here. And you speak from a place of both knowledge and moral conscience that will resonate with many, many of our listeners. Thank you so much for being my guest on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for being so generous, and thank you for having me as your guest, and thank you for what it is you do.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support of this program helps keep us on the air week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you on behalf of every one of our listeners. If you think there's value in what you've heard, please make your contribution today. Please keep us in mind as you plan your tax-deductible donations at the end of the year. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussions you find there. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.